From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. Christianity after religion. The end of church and the birth of a new spiritual awakening. On February 14th, Harper One published a book by that title written by Diana Butler Bass, and that book continues to rank highly on religion and spirituality bestseller lists. On April 17, the Free Press released the latest book by Ross Douthat. The title is Bad Religion, How We Became a Nation of Heretics. And that book also continues to rank highly on religion and spirituality bestseller lists. Now, the remarkable thing is, each of these well-received books starts with a similar acknowledgement that traditional religion, specifically mainstream Christianity, is facing giant challenges in 2012 America. Both authors acknowledge the vast influence of organized religion on our culture and society. And then, at that point, these authors diverge wildly on both their analyses of how we got to where we are, as well as on what needs to happen next. But taken together, these books help us get a fascinating, if unplanned, cumulative look at two very divergent perspectives on a single issue that is vitally important to many millions of the American people. Earlier this summer, a dialogue began between the two authors involved. On July 14th, in the pages of the New York Times, where he's the youngest op-ed writer in history, Mr. Douthat stated bluntly that, quote, liberal Christianity has simply collapsed. Dr. Bass quickly responded in the Huffington Post, where she comments regularly on culture and religion. Her column was headlined, Can Christianity Be Saved? A response to Ross Douthat. Well, it wasn't long, you got it, before Mr. Douthat took to his New York Times blog to craft his response to Dr. Bass. Well, the exchange makes for fascinating reading. Here are two sharp minds with divergent viewpoints, but each author sincere and studied in the author's knowledge of the issue. That's why, in following this public correspondence, we felt it could be both interesting and important to bring these minds together for a face-to-face conversation. There's a lot to be learned, and that's precisely what we've done. So with me in the studio right now is Ross Douthat, author of Bad Religion, and joining me also is Dr. Diana Butler Bass, author of Christianity After Religion. I have locked the door. And so I welcome both of you to State of Belief Radio. Thanks for being here.
It's great. I'm glad that it's not just my mind, but my body, too, that's here.
That's right.
The power of prayer can unlock any door, though, so just keep that in mind. Thanks so much for having us.
Oh, that's great. I want to start, as you would expect, with an overview of where are we headed from each of your perspectives. Doesn't matter who goes first, because I want to hear from each of you. So,
sure, I can start. I'll try and be quick. Basically, I think the central place that both of our books start from is the fact that over the last 10 years, especially, but really over the last couple of generations, there has been what you might call a deinstitutionalization of American Christianity, in which institutional churches, both Catholic and Protestant, have gotten weaker overall. Even though, if you ask Americans, do you believe in God? How, you know, do you pray, and so on? America looks roughly as religious in that sense as ever. So we're a less churched country, but still a very religious country. So there's this broader trend, and then there's, I think, an acceleration of the trend in the last decade. And I think Dr. Bass refers to a religious recession, really dating it rightly back to either the first part of the third millennium or even the 1990s. And that shows up in what a couple of sociologists have called the nones, not N-U-N-S, but N-O-N-E-S, Americans who say they have no religious affiliation. You know, they aren't Methodists or Presbyterians or Catholics. And this is one of the new and striking religious trends in American life. And so overall, we're looking at a landscape where the traditional Christian churches are having a harder and harder time reaching people, and this phenomenon exists across the spectrum. And, you know, we can discuss sort of the liberal Christianity versus conservative Christianity divide, but I think we agree that it's a challenge facing everyone from the most conservative evangelical to the most progressive-minded Episcopalian.
I agree with everything you said, and I can tell that you've spent some time reading some things I've written, and I certainly have read some things you've written. And I was really surprised when I opened up your book and found pretty much the same diagnosis of the culture in the first several pages that, you know, that I do in my book too, because we've never met before. I had no idea you were writing the book you wrote. I don't think you had any idea I was writing.
Spies, actually. Plus around for hours. Every PDF you downloaded, I downloaded as well. And I think it suggests that, at least in terms of the data, this underlying trend is hard to argue with.
Yeah, and it's been very striking that in the last 5 or 6 years, what's come out are some of the best surveys probably ever done by sociologists about American religion. And across the board, they're revealing the same thing, is that there is this slow motion collapse of institutional Christianity that's been going on since the 1970s. And then what I call the Great Religious Recession, the acceleration really since the beginning of the millennium. And that has profound consequences on American society as a whole, consequences that I'm actually quite worried about, as I know that you are too. And this is a changing moment of the way that Americans are thinking about their religious lives, are gathering in community, and will be exploring how you generate sort of communities of practice that create spiritual and social capital that are related to larger issues about poverty and how we get along as a country, politics. And so I think that this is a really important subject. And I'm really glad that you have tackled it as well.
Are we at a crisis moment or an opportunity moment?
The language of slow motion that you just used, I think, is very useful because it is a crisis moment, but it's a slow burning crisis. You know, we're not going to wake up tomorrow and find that, you know, the Roman Catholic Church in the United States has suddenly disappeared or anything like that. We're still living in a country that has very significant institutional churches where, you know, sort of institutional religion is still very influential, notwithstanding its decline. So it's not that the house is, you know, on fire in every room or something. Mm-hmm. It's more that the house is slowly sinking into quicksand or something, mm-hmm. if I can mix metaphors a little.
Nice biblical analogy, though. Yeah. You know, you got to look out for that sand. I think that part of the question about is this a crisis or is it an opportunity, I always think that those two things are very closely related. Mm-hmm. But I also think that it depends on what sort of quarter of Christianity in the United States you're looking at. I think that for legacy Protestantism or ecumenical Protestantism or liberal Protestantism, whatever you want to call it, the thing that we used to call mainline churches, I think it actually is a crisis over there. And, you know, I am one. I'm an Episcopalian and known as a progressive or liberal Episcopalian. These are churches I love. I work with them all the time. But I am also willing to say, hey, I think this house is on fire. And you could see that this summer, as you wrote about, in the conventions that were held once every 12 years, the Methodists, Presbyterians, and Episcopalians all meet in the same summer in their big national meetings. And that was this past summer. And it was interesting to watch the three meetings. Of the three denominations. You wrote about the Episcopal Church. But in some ways, their meeting was the most promising and optimistic of the three meetings. You move away from the sort of the hot button issues of sexuality, especially the things about transgendered ordination, homosexual marriage. And you look at the sort of the broader scope of what the Episcopal Church tackled. It was very interesting. One of their set of resolutions was actually to take themselves completely apart as a denomination and to try to figure out what it would mean to restructure the entire institution of the Episcopal Church based on a vision of mission rather than simply a vision of how are we going to maintain this big organization. They should probably be moving a little faster, but it's a big organization. It's an old one. But they are taking measured steps to try to think about some of the issues I think that you actually raise about what does a healthy Christian institution look like for the 21st century. But the Methodists and Presbyterians did not do that. They're in a muddle.
We've got to take a short break, but the conversation obviously is just getting started. My guests are Ross Douthat and Diana Butler Bass. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Welcome back, everyone, to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. In the studio with me are Ross Douthat, author of Bad Religion, How We Became a Nation of Heretics, and Dr. Diana Butler Bass. Her book is titled Christianity After Religion, The End of Church and the Birth of a New Spiritual Awakening. You are on the same page as to where we are. Would you, Mr. Douthat, kind of describe where you see it going, and then we'll begin to pick into all this?
Sure. I mean, I think that, you know, we both see a crisis and we both see opportunities, and I tend to lean more towards the crisis side, and she tends to lean more towards the opportunity side. And that reflects, I think, some pretty significant theological disagreements. I think that ultimately any kind of sustainable Christian revival has to be what I describe in my book as an orthodox revival. And I'm using the term sort of small o orthodox, that's ultimately rooted in the idea that there is a kind of unchanging core of Christian faith, right, that dates back to, you know, to the first century AD, dates back to the great ecumenical councils of the church in the fourth century, you know, finds expression in the canon of scriptures, the Nicene Creed, and so on. And then also, I think, finds expression in certain basic moral commitments having to do with a skepticism of materialism and great wealth, a strong emphasis on chastity and sexual matters, and so on. And I think that, one, that constitutes the core of Christian faith, and two, that I don't think that there is a sort of correlation where the most orthodox churches are necessarily the most thriving ones. In fact, I think it's quite the opposite. A lot of what we describe as quote-unquote conservative religion in the United States is conservative in the sense of being politically conservative, on the conservative side of culture war issues to some extent, but I think departs from Christian orthodoxy in profound ways. And if you think about a figure like Joel Osteen and sort of the influence of the prosperity gospel on Christianity in the U.S., I think you can see an example of that. I'm not coming forward with a blueprint that says be more orthodox and, you know, and you will grow. Instead, I'm sort of arguing that orthodoxy is the truest form of Christian faith, and that a Christianity that sort of seeks self-consciously to move beyond that core will, you know, one, eventually sort of cease to have any kind of Christian identity at all, and two, that as that's already happened in American life, it's produced overall fairly negative results. And so my sense is that you can already see what a Christianity after religion, a Christianity after church looks like in the U.S. today, and it's visible in sort of polls of sort of the younger generation and their views about God and morality and so on. And it's overall not a positive picture. It's a more narcissistic picture, a more sort of self-absorbed picture. That's my overview. And how about yours?
I think that some of the difference we have certainly is theological, and I'm very excited about that. I would have responded to your last response to me, except I got the flu, and so I was down for 10 days.
And here we are today.
And so I was sitting in my bed thinking, I want to write a thing, and it would have been engaging more theologically. But I also do think that it's a difference about where we're looking. And one of the things that I've done over the last decade, and you may or may not be aware of that, is that I've spent a lot of time with the microclimate, as it were,
right,
of Protestant congregations. And so I know all the research you're referring to about young adults. So I'm aware of this kind of thin gruel of picture of what Christianity looks like that does show up in the national polls. But what I'm also very aware of is that sort of off of everybody's radar screens, there has been developing over the course of the same period of collapse, what I would call sort of isolated congregations that are demonstrating a whole different kind of vision that arises out of the old liberal tradition, but is also something different. And those congregations are congregations that are not necessarily interested in saying we are Orthodox. They don't start with that kind of language or that kind of doctrine test. But they do start with the story of Jesus and who Jesus was and what Jesus intended for human life. There's been a huge recovery in many congregations in the mainline tradition of understanding Jesus' great command to love God and love our neighbors as ourselves, and to try to stitch together a congregational or communal life that's really based out of this deepest sort of core teaching of Jesus himself. So it's not necessarily a return to the core teaching in the sense of the creeds, but a core teaching of looking at the life and ministry and work of Jesus and saying, well, what was that all about? And what is really the center point of being a follower of God as Jesus himself taught and lived when he was here on earth? And so there's been this passionate sort of recovery. There's a deep and renewed commitment in some of these churches towards practices that come out of Christian monastic tradition. You are as likely in some mainline congregations today to find people who are familiar with the rule of Saint Benedict,
right,
as you are to find people who are voting for President Obama in November. And that's something that the media doesn't actually know.
I'm going to spring in and say that that's a wonderful thing. You know, I'm a political conservative, obviously sort of in a professional capacity, and also obviously a theological conservative. But I think American Christianity needs a liberal Christianity, that it needs a Christianity that is identified with social reform, you know, and sort of the idea that Christianity should manifest itself in sort of political concerns and struggle against injustice and so on. And you cannot have a vibrant American Christianity that only appeals to people who are members of the Republican Party. And to the extent that what you're describing is a real phenomenon within liberal churches and congregations, I think it's a wonderful thing. And I think it is exactly what liberal Christianity needs. And there are a lot of sort of what you might call crunchy conservatives, mm-hmm, in a way, who see the way to build a future for conservative Christianity in the United States is to be mainly about building similarly communities of practice that model Christianity to the culture as a whole.
Boy, I hate to interrupt the conversation, but we've got to take a quick break here. There's a lot more still to come with Diana Butler Bass and Ross Douthit. I'm Welton Gaddy. We're coming right back. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. This free State of Belief Radio podcast is brought to you by Interfaith Alliance, representing 185,000 members across the U.S., drawn from 75 different faith traditions. We're committed to protecting faith and freedom. Find out about the work we do to protect the boundaries between religion and government and unite diverse voices to challenge extremism and build common ground by visiting our website, interfaithalliance.org. Whether you care deeply about minority religious rights, school bullying, LGBT discrimination, the influence of religion on politics, or the influence of politics on religion, Interfaith Alliance is working on initiatives you'll want to support. Learn more and become a member at interfaithalliance.org. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio and a really, really good conversation that I'm enjoying. I'm Welton Gaddy. Dr. Diana Butler Bass is the author of Christianity After Religion, The End of Church and the Birth of a New Spiritual Awakening. Diana writes frequently on culture and religion for the Huffington Post and for the Washington Post On Faith section. Ross Douthit is an op-ed columnist at the New York Times. His latest book is Bad Religion, How We Became a Nation of Heretics. And both of them are here in the studio with me today. There are a lot of people who say, Mr. Douthit, when you talk about a core of Christianity, that you're wanting to simply retreat into the old hierarchical Christianity in which there was privilege and in which there was security and in which you basically didn't mix it up in the social process. You just stayed with, well, I'm going to be a doctrinaire Christian. On the other hand, Dr. Bass, with you, I hear people saying she and her kind have just given up on the gospel. They rightly want Christianity to be relevant, but they have weakened it to the point that it's a kind of Christianity light doing social policy that is stronger than Christianity itself. So I'd like for both of you to respond to those respective criticisms, because I think it'll help people understand better where each of you is.
One of the things that I take from the liberal Christian traditions is that there are self-correcting mechanisms within it. One part I liked best about your book, Ross, was the really great discussions of neo-orthodoxy. And when I look at Christian history, I see neo-orthodoxy as one of those self-corrective moments right. of Protestant liberalism, where, you know, people like Barth and Bonhoeffer and Martin Luther King Jr. and other folks who are in the neo-orthodox tradition looked back and said, well, liberalism got this stuff right about social justice, but it also became too full of its own self. It was full of hubris, and that it was not full enough of God, nor was it full enough of
an awareness of human sin.
Yeah,
right. And the imperfect abilities
right.
of human nature.
Yeah, of human sin. And so you get this whole then, you know, generation of people who try to take sin as seriously doctrinally, and also the idea of humility seriously doctrinally, and they remake liberalism on it. And you can actually, I think, argue successfully that the energy and the growth of a lot of mainline churches after World War II are directly the result of that theological self-correction of liberalism. So to take that kind of vision about what the liberal tradition can do is when it goes off the rails, it does have the capacity to correct itself. And I think that in the last 15 to 20 years, there's been a whole new generation of young liberal theologians and church leaders who have been involved in that project. It started around 1980 with the theological voices out of Yale of Hans Frey and George Limbeck articulating for the first time something that was called post-liberal theology. And that group of students who were in mainline seminaries in the 1980s took some of that insight from the post-liberal project, as it were, and began to apply it in congregations. And I think that's what you see today in those pockets of vitality where I was talking about mainline churches that are doing well, it's really sort of taking the emphasis from post-liberalism, which was to go back and re-examine tradition, and it was to go back and to recommit ourselves to the stories of ancient Christianity and also to base life around the idea of sustained practices in community. It took those three insights out of the post-liberal tradition and began applying them in congregations. And so now we've had about 15 or 20 years of this on the ground, very mealy sort of self-correction of the liberal tradition going on. And so to me, yes, I think that the liberalism I grew up with in the 1960s in my Methodist church in Maryland, it stunk. It was boring. It was irrelevant. It offered no possibility of a young person like myself who was passionate to live a life in God to connect in any meaningful way with Scripture or with Jesus. But that kind of liberalism is now just kind of a stereotype of what liberalism used to be. And what it has become in some of its quarters is this very alternative, extremely demanding, different way of living one's life in congregations. It's not every congregation. It's a small percentage of congregations. Maybe 8 to 10% of mainline congregations demonstrate some level of this commitment to sort of postmodern or post-liberal sort of stuff. So it's by no means everybody, but it's a lot of people.
I think people often tend to underestimate the extent to which dogma sustains practice and even sustains activism, or especially mm-hmm. sustains activism. And that if you look at in American history, certainly the great social reformers who are influenced by Christianity, they tended to be in certain ways extremely biblical in their faith, extremely dogmatic in their faith, often fairly supernatural in their faith. And this is a line that runs back from Martin Luther King through William Jennings Bryan back to the abolitionists. And so to the claim that a more dogmatic faith just serves to sort of reinforce existing social hierarchies, look, obviously sometimes that's true. And, mm-hmm. I'm Catholic, and the Catholic Church has a long history of sort of complicity with existing power structures. But then again, if you look around the world today, you see parts of the world like Latin America where the Catholic Church was a force for reaction and sided with military dictatorships against communists and socialists and so on. But then you see other parts of the world like Korea, East Asia, and often Africa as well. And again, these are places where the church is less embedded in existing social hierarchies and it becomes an agent of reform, Catholic bishops and cardinals and so on. So I think it can run both ways, but I think dogma does not have to be an impediment to reform and can even assist it. And then second, to your point about sort of whether we're living through a kind of equivalent of the neo-Orthodox moment, where liberal Christianity is finding a way to self-correct, what I see as missing, I think that if there were a kind of, a Reinhold Niebuhr of liberal Christianity today, right, somebody who was sort of within the liberal tradition but was really focused on where liberal Christianity was getting things wrong, he would be focused on sex. I think that liberal Christianity has a sex problem, and I think it's an understandable sex problem because I think liberal Christians rightly during the era of, the era of sort of the feminist revolution in the 60s and 70s and then also to a certain extent with the gay rights revolution, had a deep and appropriate desire to overcome sort of elements of bigotry within the Christian tradition, elements of sexism and so on. But I think that commitment has tended to carry liberal Christianity to a point where it ends up effacing or ignoring what I think is the pretty plain message – and again, we're getting back to that question of a core – but the pretty plain message of the New Testament, Jesus himself, the witness of the early church and so on, which is a Philip Reef had this – he describes it as a rejection of sexual individualism. And I think if you look at American society today, I think it's fair to at least submit the possibility that we're living through an era where sexual individualism has kind of run amok. Mm-hmm. And I think that the liberal churches, again, for reasons having to do with a desire to defend the movement towards female equality, and to sort of avoid the tendency towards homophobia have failed to maintain a language that speaks to those issues. And bracketing the question of homosexuality have failed to develop a language that speaks to issues like premarital sex, divorce, mm-hmm. out-of-wedlock childbearing, and so on. And if I were sitting here with a Republican Christian and so on, I think I'd be talking about money instead mm-hmm. of sex because – you know, that core has some pretty strong things to say about money. But I think in the case of the liberal tradition right now, and again, maybe it's different in these particular communities you're talking about, but I think there isn't a real confrontation with the gulf between what the New Testament says about sex and the way we live now.
I think that Americans have a sex problem. And
maybe humanity has a sex problem.
I think that that might be part of the sin. Genesis has something to say about that.
What does each of you most disagree with in the argument of the other?
Ross had said it actually earlier, and that is he says he wants to begin with dogma and move toward mm-hmm. Moral formation. And actually, that's exactly the opposite way that I move, starting with a practice, honoring one's body, and then moving toward belief or doctrine or dogma is the way that liberals are currently, and post-liberals, if we're talking about that tradition, the renewing tradition, the way that we move. We start in practice. We start in sort of the lived experience of the community mm-hmm. over time, because we include the longer historic experience of the church. But it's out of practice that we come to form belief and doctrine, rather than the idea that there is an unchanging core of faith that you give your life to and then out of that develop a set of practices. So I actually hear that as exactly the opposite.
I think it's a little blurrier than exactly the opposite. I mean, for the sake of the argument, I think it is sort of the nub of the disagreement is the I think that you would agree that, you know, dogma isn't inconsequential, and I would agree that, you know, sort of person that experience and life and community isn't inconsequential. But the relative weight that we give to dogma, I think, is the biggest difference between us. And the relative weight we give to the importance of sort of, you know, specificity in commandments, you might say, mm-hmm. right? And so to what extent does authority reside in the Bible, the church, you mm-hmm. know, and sort of the historical deposit of faith? And to what extent does it reside in the experience of the community right now? And this really is, I think, mm-hmm. the biggest sort of liberal, conservative, mm-hmm. progressive, orthodox, whatever division you want to make, that's the biggest divide. It's the, you know, and it is sort of a chicken and the egg, you know, dogma and practice kind of question.
But it has consequences for which comes first.
Right. And it has consequences for how, I mean, to get back to sort of where liberal Protestant communities are trying to begin, gets back to, you know, how do you think about the words of Jesus? How do you think mm-hmm. about the function of the New Testament message in the life of faith and so on? And how do you think about the authority of that message? And how far are you willing to go in revising that message depending on personal experience and contemporary realities? And my view is that the temptation in liberal circles is to go so far that you end up unraveling the, you know, you pull the thread out so far and suddenly you've unraveled the place mm-hmm. you began. And then, why are we Christians again anyway if we think that Jesus got this wrong and Paul got that wrong and it was the first century and they didn't know what we know now? You know, if you see what I mean, I think that's the danger, that you follow the thread so far that you look back to the beginning and say, well, you know, Jesus, nice guy, got a lot of things right, got a bunch of things wrong. You know, Buddha, same way. We're sort of mixing and matching, and then you aren't really, you know, there isn't any there anymore. That's the apocalyptic.
That's the stereotypical.
Right. But
you have a quick comment on that.
Well, about 40 years ago, an Episcopal theologian who unfortunately died far too young, named Urban Holmes, wrote an incredible essay called Praying Shapes Believing. And I think that that essay has had sort of a seminal impact on certainly me, but I think also a lot of what's going on in the mainline is that our beliefs really do spring out of the life of liturgy and prayer, out of how the community lives together in those places. That whole sense of practice, preceding belief, I think is really important. And what you say about belief preceding practice, you can run to the edges of those and find the stereotypes, or you can have a really good discussion that we're having that begins to sort of understand the nuances of that and how that works together for the what could be the good of Christianity in America for the future.
There's still more of this conversation and all of the interviews you hear on this show available online. Please go to stateofbelief.com, turn up your computer speakers. You'll also hear more from Ross Douthit and Diana Butler Bass after a short break. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio, everyone. I'm Welton Gaddy. I'm joined today by Ross Douthit, author of the book Bad Religion, How We Became a Nation of Heretics, and Dr. Diana Butler Bass, who's the author of Christianity After Religion, The End of Church and the Birth of a New Spiritual Awakening. What in contemporary Christianity most excites you?
The crisis is actually the thing that excites me the most. People are engaged in some really interesting discussions in the ground level. People are having really fascinating arguments. The institutions are really struggling right now to pay their bills and think about what the ministry is going to look like for the future and who should be ordained and, you know, can we marry these people and not these people and what happens if we pray for this and public prayers. And so the whole level of energy and fervor and even argument is, to me, the place of enthusiasm, because it opens up a possibility that people are ready to change and that people do actually still love these old institutions and see them as valuable and want them to continue in some fashion for the future, but they don't really know how to do it. So it's a great time for imagination and creativity.
Mr. Douthit?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, to come to somewhere where we agree again, I think the in decline, there is the possibility and the reality that Christianity becomes countercultural in a stronger way than it's been at certain points in the American past. And, you know, Christianity is supposed to be a countercultural religion. It's a religion that was founded on the, you know, the crucifixion of somebody we believe to be the Son of God alongside two common criminals. You can't really get much more sort of counter the, you know, institutions of the age than that. And I think you can take that line too far. I mean, I'll have people say to me, you know, well, because Christianity is more countercultural today, that shows we haven't really lost anything and so on. I don't think that's right. I think we have lost a lot of things over the last 50 years. But it's still the case that a crisis is an opportunity, and it's a particular opportunity for a faith like Christianity that isn't supposed to get too comfortable in any particular culture, any particular time and place. And it's true. It's true for the mainline in their struggles. It's true for, you know, more theologically conservative Christians who feel sort of marginalized. You know, it's you're supposed to be the salt of the earth and all that, and there are real chances to do that in a society that is a little more hostile to your faith than it used to be.
I really appreciate both of you coming to the studio. I appreciate the kind of conversation we've had. It occurs to me that for a person concerned about authentic Christianity, that whether you start with where Ross is or whether you start with where Diana is, if you're going to be thorough in your thought, you have to give attention to what each one of you has said in order to keep the whole thing together. Because there is a tension in religion always that requires both an interest in the core and an interest in the relevance, and those two have to be held in some kind of tension. Thank you all very much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Please visit us online at stateofbelief.com. To find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, read transcripts, sign up for our podcast. You can learn about the new State of Belief app for iPhone and Android devices. Share your thoughts, please, on what you've heard today on Facebook and Twitter. Contact information is available at stateofbelief.com, including the toll-free listener line 800-856-0277. And we encourage you to tell other people about the show, your friends, your family members. Encourage them to listen also. Tell them you want to talk about what we've been talking about on the air. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. We can talk about every bit of that, promoting civility as well. We'll do it again next week. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, Welton.